1977 at the Arkansas Camp Meeting, and this is number 3 in our series on the seven angels. We come back now and spend a few important minutes on the study of the first and the second angels' messages and the third before we plunge into a more direct study of the last ones with which we're not so familiar. But there are some thoughts I think we could do well to share in regard to these first angels before we move on to the last ones. Revelation 14 verse 6. And I saw another angel. Now I'm frequently asked as I preach this message why it says that the first angel is another angel. This tends to make us look, of course, for other angels prior to this one. Now, of course, a brief moment's reflection will take your mind back through seven sealing angels and seven trumpet angels and the angels of the seven churches in the second and third chapter of the book. And what God desires us to understand is that we now have a distinct and separate series of angels comprising a new prophecy being brought to view in this series of verses. So there are other angels prior to this one, though not in this series. We know in the spirit of prophecy that this angel is distinctly called the first angel's message, followed by the second, the Revelation 14 verse 8, and the Bible itself says in verse 9, and the third angel followed them. So even though the first verse of the series says another angel, we recognize that the other angels do not belong to the series. Otherwise, why does verse 9 say, and the third angel followed them, namely, of course, the first and the second? We read again now the verse, and I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven. What's the next word? Having. Give me some strong words that you'd use as synonyms of that word having. Possessing. Good. That's the strongest ones we can find. Possessing. Possessing what? Possessing the everlasting gospel to preach unto them that dwell upon the earth and to every nation and kindred and tongue and people. Now, I'm very deeply impressed by the way in which this verse, first of all, says the angel has, first, and then he preaches what he has. That unveils for us an extremely important Bible principle, because most certainly you can never give what you don't have. And many people go out and they preach what they declare to be the proclamation of the gospel of Jesus Christ. But what they're proclaiming is, in fact, a theory, an argument, a compendium of knowledge about certain facts, but they are not preaching the living gospel of Jesus Christ. Because the gospel is much more than a collection of facts, a compendium of knowledge, a doctrine, a theory, a dogma, or such like. If you turn back to Romans 1 verse 16, you'll find what the gospel of Jesus Christ is. Therefore says, for I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation. The gospel is the power of God. And we must in our minds divorce the gospel from argument or theory. We must think of it in terms of pulsing power capable of effecting things in the lives of those it comes to save, commensurate with the measure of that power. And what is the measure of that power? It is the power of God sent down to this earth to effect our salvation. Now, human minds, of course, cannot begin to comprehend the extent of that power, and the nearest we can come to it is to enlarge our understanding of the immensity and vastness of space and of the gigantic orbs which are moving in measured procession through that space. Some of us have travelled widely, some not so widely, and those of us who have travelled around the world have some concept of its size, but even that is not a very accurate concept. But out there in space, this world is considered a very, very tiny planet indeed. There are gigantic orbs out there, vastly greater in size than this little Earth is. And when we realize that God spake, just spoke, and there was the world, the sun, the planets, the stars, and when we consider the multiplicity of those planets and stars, billions of them, reaching out beyond the limits of man's most powerful telescopes, and realize that God spoke all those into existence by his mighty power, then what a God of power our powerful God must be. And if the gospel is the power of that God, then what a power that gospel must in turn be. Now the people who proclaim the everlasting gospel, as symbolized by this angel, must be a people who first of all have the gospel. It must be their experience. It must be their characters. It must be their very natures, their new disposition, because they certainly cannot impart power for the salvation of others unless they first of all have that power themselves. And it is true that when William Miller and Joshua V. Himes came in the early days of the proclamation of the first angel's message, they came as very power-filled preachers. Not just powerful, but power-filled. And wherever they went, they left behind them a train of transformed lives. Men and women delivered from the power of sin to live a new life of righteousness. It's tragic, of course, that their successors, who claim today to be the proclaimers of the first angel's message, do not possess that same power and do not see the same results in those to whom they preach. The first angel's message proclaimed the power of God to every nation, kindred, tongue and people. But the first angel did not and could not finish the work. Now why not? Because there needed to be added to his work further light to guide the people of God into correct and safe paths. We must exercise great care in what we say here, because the second angel did not bring any light and could not bring any light beyond that which the first angel proclaimed, because the first angel proclaimed the everlasting gospel, the cross of Jesus Christ, and what can we preach beside the gospel? Nothing. There are those who contend that the Bible is composed of certain divisions, a prophetic division, a doctrinal area, an historical part, and of course we have the gospel scattered through here and there. Is that a correct understanding of the Word of God? Not at all. There is only one subject in the Word of God, and that is the gospel of Jesus Christ. This book from cover to cover is the revelation of God's power to save. And only when prophecy is correctly presented as the gospel of Jesus Christ is prophecy truly being preached. Likewise with history, likewise with so-called doctrine, and so forth. In fact, if you ask the average Seventh-day Adventist person today, which are the two great prophetic books of the Bible, they will say Daniel and the Revelation. And ask them then, name the gospel books of the Bible, they will certainly say Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, and the writings of Paul, Romans, Galatians, Ephesians, Corinthians and so on. Then ask them the question, is the book of Revelation a revelation of the gospel of Jesus Christ? And they'll say, why, hardly. It's a book of prophecy and history, a book of politics and battles and wars. But in the book, Counsels to Writers and Editors, there's a very, very revealing statement in this respect. It's found on page 175, Counsels to Writers and Editors. And in that statement, Sister White says, our task is to understand the gospel that Christ revealed to John on the Isle of Patmos, that gospel which is termed the revelation of Jesus Christ which God gave unto him. Therefore, the book of Revelation is what? The gospel of Jesus Christ. And inasmuch as Revelation is the unfolding of Daniel, then what must Daniel also be? The gospel of Jesus Christ. If we fail to recognize the gospel of Jesus Christ in every letter and every word of Revelation, then we fail to understand the message of that great book that must follow. Now, Paul, when he came to the Galatians, and we'll turn back to Galatians, the first chapter. I'm going to really enjoy the book of Galatians more as the camp period goes by. But in Galatians chapter 1, Paul emphasizes how vitally important this gospel is. In verse 6 down to verse 9, he speaks as follows. I marvel that you are so soon removed from him that called you into the grace of Christ unto another gospel, which is not another, but there be some that trouble you and would pervert the gospel of Christ. But though we or an angel from heaven preach any other gospel unto you than that which we have preached unto you, let him be accursed, or as the margin says, damned, or anathema. As we said before, so say I now again, if any man preach any other gospel unto you than that you have received, let him be accursed. Turn now to 1 Corinthians 2 and verse 2. Paul lays out the limitations of his preaching amongst the Corinthians, and where he says, for I determined not to know anything among you save Jesus Christ and him crucified. And Paul then proceeded, of course, to reveal the cross of Christ to the Corinthians. But as you read Corinthians through, you do get the impression that there's quite a deal of doctrine, admonition, exhortation, quite a deal about the law, and so forth, to these people. And it appears that Paul started out with a good resolution from which he departed. It appears that way until we understand that when Paul preached the law, he preached the gospel. When Paul exhorted, he preached the gospel. If we understand what Paul was saying, we'll see the gospel in every word that Paul spoke in this great and wonderful presentation of truth to the Corinthians. Now, down in these last days, are we to join with Paul and say together with him that we are determined not to know anything amongst anybody save Jesus Christ and him crucified? Must that be our resolution? Absolutely. So then, when we come back to Revelation chapter 14, and the first angel brings the everlasting gospel, he brought everything that was ever needed by way of light through which the work of God could be finished. So why then a second angel, a third, a fourth, a fifth, a sixth, and a seventh? The second angel comes to reveal to the people of God the effect of the preaching of the gospel. Therefore, he didn't bring another gospel or an additional gospel. He simply told the people of God the results of the proclamation of the everlasting gospel. Now, later in this week, we're going to spend some time studying the Old and New Covenants, the experience of Abraham with Sarah and Hagar and Ishmael, and finally Isaac. And we will grasp, I think, more clearly the effect of the bringing of the gospel of Jesus Christ into direct contact with the power of sin. Now, the people of God should be aware of this. But if we go back to 1844 and earlier, the children of God then were a people who had just come out of Babylonian darkness. They had been in their churches, be it the Methodist, Baptist, Presbyterian, or whatever, in many cases all the days of their lives, and they loved those churches, and they could not believe that those dear ministers and godly folk within that church could turn their backs upon the living truth of God. That was hard to believe. They didn't appreciate the fact that there is a natural hostility between the truth of God and organized old covenant church religion. They couldn't appreciate that fact. Now, I've had people come to me, and they've no doubt come to you and say, well, look, I know a Seventh-day Adventist minister. They're just a model of kindness and courtesy and politeness, and they testify to a living experience, and they're just the sweetest people you'd ever want to meet. And I just can't believe that those folk have turned their backs upon the truth of God to this time. Have you heard those kind of assertions? Certainly we have. Now, later on this week, we are going to deal with that law in Galatians, and that's going to bring out some very beautiful truths that will help us to understand the situation of those people in those churches with greater clarity than we've ever known before. And so the believers back in 1844 found it very, very hard to realize the true results of the preaching of that gospel, and so God needed to send to them a second angel to reveal to them the results of the preaching of the first angel's message, which results were Babylon is fallen, come out of her, my people. Now, when that message came, of course, and revealed to the Advent folk that great truth, they were prepared to leave, and they did leave. Now, come back a moment now, and let's study the transition from the position in which those folk found themselves to what they became when the preaching of the gospel was brought to them. Right, now we'll go back then to the days, shall we say, of Martin Luther, and from Luther on to the Wesleys, and of course John and Charles Wesley, under God, sought to bring a revival and a restoration back to God of the great Protestant organizations of their day, but they sadly were rejected. And Wesley, as we know, lived in what we know as the 18th century. Wesley was born in 1703 and he died in 1791, and he came to really understand the truth somewhere, I think, about 1760. Now, after the death of Wesley, another 30-odd years go by before we find this wonderful date, 1831, and during that period, the Protestant churches had declined into a very serious state of deep apostasy. They had become worldly and world-loving, and their practices, of course, were after the principles of this world. Yet they professed to be God's people, they taught the law of God, and as such, because they did not have new hearts, and yet said all that God has said will we do, they were an old covenant church organization. Now, in the Old Testament picture, symbolism, in the type, in the forebelt, what is the symbol, the outstanding symbol of the old covenant situation? Ishmael, right? Paul says so in Galatians, the fourth chapter. Now, we're just going ahead of ourselves a bit here. You understand this a little better when we go on later to the study of the law, but I'll mention it now and this will ring bells for you later. Now, there came a time when the child of promise was born, whose name was Isaac, and he was a child of faith and not the child of works. And when the child of faith appeared, what did the child of works do to the child of faith? Persecuted him. And what says the scripture? Cast out the bondwoman and her son. Why? Because the son of the bondwoman shall not be heir with the son of the free woman. And persecution will always be generated from the child of the bondwoman to the child, against the child of the free woman. Now, when the great first, well, the great second angel's message, the great second advent message was proclaimed back at that time, then that called upon the churches of that day to abandon their old covenant program of works and to become a people of faith. But instead of yielding to the call of the gospel and its offering of power to make that transformation, what did those people do? They resisted that call. Now, when you start to resist something, it requires efforts. In the physical world, of course, if you resist something which is a physical demand upon you, such as maybe someone's trying to pull you back downhill or you're trying to go uphill, then you exert all the muscular power you've got to resist that pull. And when you start to exercise your muscle, what becomes of them? They become strengthened. So likewise, when people begin to resist the drawing power of God's love, they have to exercise the muscles of spiritual resistance in order to resist the call of God. And as they exercise those spiritual muscles in resistance, what do those resistance muscles become? Strengthened. And so they become hardened, because a strong muscle is a very hard muscle, and they become hardened then in their rejection and rebellion of the truth of God. With the result that the churches in 1844 experienced a moral fall in consequence of their rejection of the truths of the great second advent message. Quote, Great Controversy, page 389. Now then, as I said before, the advent people who accepted the message didn't understand that, and they needed to have told to them through the second angel's message the fact of it. So when they could realize the fallen state of that church, which had become Babylon, then they could separate themselves physically from it. But the second angel's message did more than that. The second angel's message also proclaimed what had happened in the people of God themselves. Because the message, Babylon is fallen, is a message of sweet music to God's true people. What is Babylon? Babylon is the principle of placing self in God's place. That is what Babylon is. Come back to Daniel chapter 2 with me for a moment, and we'll see that spirit of Babylon exemplified and revealed in the experience of King Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel, the second chapter, the vision of the great image, and in verse 37 and 38, we find God spoke these words to his faithful servant, to the great king Nebuchadnezzar. Thou, O king, art the king of kings. Now listen carefully, for the God of heaven hath given thee a kingdom, power, and strength and glory. And note those words, the God of heaven hath given thee. Verse 38, and wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field and the fowls of the heaven, hath he given to thine hand, and hath made thee ruler over them all. Thou art this head of gold. Let's emphasize the words, hath he given into thine hand, and hath made thee ruler over them all. So Nebuchadnezzar was where he was because God had put him there. That's clear. Now we recognize, of course, that God had not been participant in the methods that Nebuchadnezzar had used. The reason why God is attributed as putting Nebuchadnezzar there is because Nebuchadnezzar had used certain correct principles of hard work, industry, wisdom, and so forth. But all the powers that Nebuchadnezzar had used for good or ill had come to him from God and not from himself. Now, a little later, when we have the vision of the great tree in the sixth chapter of the same book, I beg your pardon, it's the fourth chapter. The fourth chapter of the same book, we find the experience of the great tree. When Nebuchadnezzar had this dream and saw himself as being the... God revealed to him that he was the king of the whole world. We find that likewise, God said that he sets up kings and takes down kings. I just read that verse again. Verse 17. This matter is by the decree of the watchers and demand of the word of the holy ones, to the intent that the living may know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will, and setteth up over it the basis of men. Right. Now Nebuchadnezzar then was plainly shown by God that every last bit of power and wisdom, whether he used that power rightfully or wrongly, came from God, and he had nothing which came from himself initially or basically. And today, of course, it would be well for God's folk to keep before their minds the continual reminder that every minute of every day we are being protected by God's almighty power. And but for that protection, we're dead. And every day we live and move and have our being by the power that comes from the throne of God. Without that, we can do nothing. But the tragedy is that the human race becomes very self-sufficient, and they get to the place where they think that everything comes from them, and they don't need God. And when they do that, they put themselves in the place of God and commit the great original sin. And this is exactly what Nebuchadnezzar did, as you read in the same chapter, we read verse 28 on, all this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar. This is Daniel chapter 4, verse 29 now. At the end of 12 months, he walked in the palace of the kingdom of Babylon. The king spake and said, is not this great Babylon which I have built for the house of the kingdom of, by the might of my power and for the honor of my majesty? Now God had said it was God's power, God's wisdom, God's strength which had done it. Nebuchadnezzar said, no, it's my power, my strength, my wisdom and my majesty which has done this thing. Now that is the spirit of Babylon. The spirit of Babylon is to put into the place of God a man, be it yourself or somebody else, and usually, of course, it's yourself. Now, the Californian camp meeting there emerged quite unexpectedly from my point of view what I felt was a very beautiful and important truth. And I want to speak more about this as the week goes by, because I believe it'll be a great blessing to all of us, especially if we can accept it. Now, you may think that I'd be very radical if I was to say one of the greatest mistakes we could ever make, or one of the greatest mistakes anyway, is to set out to do a work for God. And that sounds radical, doesn't it? It's true. We must never set out to do a work for God. What we do rather is place ourselves at God's disposal that he may do a work for us. Those of us who set out to do a work for God will be faced with failure. It's not my business, of course, to judge various movements and organizations which have set out to do that, but we are to each one examine our own lives and motives to see what our dispositions are. But this business of setting out to do a great work for God is something which goes forth clad with a beautiful garment of apparent righteousness. Because we say we want to give our whole life to God's service, we'll make any sacrifice for God's service, we want to see God's kingdom come, and so let's go to work for God, let's cast around and find out where we can serve him and go to work and serve him, and God is going to be delighted with our sincerity and so forth. That's the robe of righteousness which covers up what really, deep down, is the principle of Babylon. Now, Abraham and Sarah, we keep coming back to these folk of course, they decided that because the child of promise had not appeared under God's direction and power, that they'd better get busy and bring forth this child on God's behalf. So what did they do? They set out to do a work for God. And they did a work. But was it for God? Did God ever accept Ishmael as the child of promise? Absolutely not. In fact, God said, I have no part with Ishmael. He can be saved as an individual, but he has no part in my scheme of things, in my great work. My promise and my covenant is with Isaac, it is not with Ishmael. And God made it very clear for all future generations to know that those of us who, like Abraham, set out to do a work for God, are setting out to do a work that God can never accept and God can never bless. Even though he may appear to have great success in that work, and we might do many wonderful things. But don't forget that in Matthew chapter 7, Christ warned that in that great day when Christ shall return, many will say, Lord, have we not done many wonderful things? Preached the gospel, worked miracles, cast out devils. And they will expect, because of their great work which they have done for God, in great sincerity, they thereby inherit a place in the kingdom. And how will Christ answer? Depart from me, you workers of iniquity, because I never knew you. Never. Now, this principle, then, of Babylon is something which is not confined to the Pope of Rome. It's a principle which endangers every human being that lives upon the face of the earth. That disposition to go forth and do a work for God instead of putting ourselves at God's disposal and letting him do a work through us. You know, in this world, everybody wants to be a somebody. That's the natural disposition. And there's very few people who have learned the great lesson that what God wants are folk who are prepared to be nobodies. And they're the ones that God can use and will use. And when God puts a man to work or a woman to work, that work will always, no exception, start as a tiny seed, never as a full-grown tree. There's nothing in the whole world of nature which ever began as a full-grown tree. How did every tree begin, every plant begin, every animal begin, every human being begin? As a tiny seed. Isn't that right? And how does God's work always begin? As a seed. Look at William Miller, John the Baptist, Jeremiah, Isaiah, even Christ himself, Peter, Paul, James, and all the other apostles. They all began as a tiny seed, and to them God came and gave a very, very little work to do. And many people say, well, that's below my dignity. I can't do a little thing like this. After all, I've got experience, I've got training, and I'm quite somebody. And so they discard that little work that God gives them to do, and then cast about to do a greater work on God's behalf. That is the most tragic mistake a person can make, because what God calls upon us to do is to accept that little tiny responsibility which he gives to us, even though it'll be very ignominious, very, very unworthwhile, and probably it may end up in complete failure and loss, and the very person whom you help may even turn around later and castigate your name. Now, I think back to the first person who ever came to me to hear this living message. I discerned right away that that person was not a man of faith, and it was clear to me that that person was not a very good prospect for the message. But just the same, I said, the Lord wants me to preach it to him, so I preached it to him. He heard it and went away and rejected it. But his blood's not upon my shoulders. And when we accept the little tasks right where we are, day by day, God will give us larger and larger and larger work to do, until if faithful in that principle of self-abnegation, God will give us a very, very large work to do in the end. When I was a young person, I was deeply impressed with the words of Milton's little sonnet on his blindness. And John Milton was blind, a great English poet and a great Puritan, a great Christian. And he just longed to get out and do a great and significant work for God. But he couldn't, because he was blind. At last he came to understand the great truth and expressed it in his poem in these words: thousands at his bidding speed, and post or land and ocean without rest. And he paused and said, they also serve who only stand and wait. And he learnt the principle of the cross in that versus the principle of Babylon. And so when the Advent message came to the Israelite, I mean the Protestant in 1831, they were a church that was hungering after prestige, power, glory, and a great earthly kingdom. So much so that they had come to teach that the 1,000 years upon this earth would be a reign of immortal glory, during which Christ would have come down to this earth, gladly recognized the great work done by the churches, and would fill the earth with a paradise of restored Edenic beauty, and everything would be very, very happy and very wonderful. The golden age was coming, they said, and was coming as a result of the work of these churches. Now, very naturally, of course, the message of the gospel called for the dethroning of that spirit that was in those churches. And to a Babylonian, in his pride and his power, what is the last thing that he wants to accept? Is it a crown or a cross? A cross. And it's not hard to understand then how back in 1831 to 1844, the message of William Miller was greeted with such hostility by a people determined to cling to their crowns and reject the cross of Calvary. Now that is the warfare, the great controversy which has gone on from the very beginning and goes right on down to the very end. And the warfare is between the spirit of Babylon and the spirit of Jesus Christ. And the spirit of Christ is the spirit of total, dedicated self-sacrifice to the cause and needs of others. It is the unfolding of that principle of taking the lowest seat and being content to occupy the lowest seat forever, whereas the principle of Babylon is the principle of self-service all the way, with a determination to take the highest seat no matter how you do it, so long as you get it. And that spirit, of course, animates the entire world at the present time. Now, these two spirits cannot dwell together. That is why, again and again and again, God calls for separation. Isn't that right? That's why God says, come out of her, my people. Right? Now, who says it? God says it. Come out of her, my people. It's difficult for God's folk to really appreciate and understand this. And so the second angel is sent to open to the minds of God's people the full outworking of the rejection of the gospel of Jesus Christ, and to call God's folk to recognize their need for separation. So then, those in whom the spirit of Babylon remains and refuse to give it up, they suffer a very, very serious moral fall. But remember this, that amongst that vast array of church people in the old covenant system of works who have the spirit of Babylon in them, there are some who will hear that message. And mark this point with care, that those in the churches who hear the message are not people without the spirit of Babylon. They have that spirit of Babylon. But when they hear the gospel, then they recognize the need for Babylon to fall, where? In them. For Babylon to be dethroned out of them and to be replaced by the living spirit of Jesus Christ. And so the second angel's message portrays the upward step of those in whom Babylon has fallen and the downward fall of those who refuse to give up Babylon and therefore fall together with her. Now, in the past, we have failed, I think, very largely to recognize that the message Babylon is fallen has a double application, both to the rejectors and to the acceptors of the first angel's message. It applies in both directions. Now, passing on to the third angel's message now, we find that it is a further announcement of the continuing result of the preaching of the first angel's message. Let's read then the verses 9 to 12 again. And the third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, if any man worship the beast in his image, and receive his mark in his forehead or in his hand, the same shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out without mixture into the cup of his indignation, and he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment ascendeth up for ever and ever, and they have no rest day nor night, who worship the beast in his image, and whoso receiveth the mark of his name. They have no rest day nor night. That's a statement that we'll look at in more detail later. But first of all, let's come back. Now, there is coming, in the very near future, the last great battle between the beast and his image on one side, and the Lamb and his seal on the other side. You know the statements, of course, in Revelation 17, where it says, these 10 kings have one mind and shall go to war against whom? Against the Lamb. The Lamb is called and chosen and faithful. Now, this warfare in the last days is not going to be a tussle to determine who has the greater physical power, that is, God or Satan. Because there's no question, there's no argument, there's no controversy about who has the greater physical power. Who has the greater physical power, God or Satan? God does. There's no question about that. Not even Satan argues about that point. So why should they fight about it if he doesn't even argue about it? There's no reason. The last great battle will be the contest between the principles of Babylon on the one side and the principles of God's kingdom on the other side. Now let's put down these two generals, and here is Satan, and Satan of course is Babylon, and here on the other side is God, and his city is Zion or Jerusalem. Now, as we have already seen, the principle of Babylon is self-exaltation. But it is self-exaltation by what means? By force. Right? By force or compulsion. You know our off-read statement from the Desire of Ages is 700 and... what's the page again? Here's the book down here. Let me find it quickly here. And the statement says that force, the use of force is found only under Satan's kingdom. God's principles are not of this order. Page 759. Compelling power is found only under Satan's government. The Lord's principles are not of this order. And back on page 21 of the same book, it says there that the use of force is contrary to God, the principles of God's government. So on the other side of the question then, we find that we have the opposite principles so far as God's government is concerned, and the principle here is selflessness, exemplified in the experience of Jesus Christ, who emptied himself and took the place in the form of what? A servant. In Jesus, in other words, Christ was prepared to come down and be an absolute nobody. Isn't that so? To vacate the place where he was the greatest of all the somebodies, up there next to God himself, and to come down and be an absolute nobody. Now, that is the exemplification of the principle of the Spirit of Christ. On the other side, we have the exemplification of the spirit of the devil. Now, in order for the people of God to become prepared to fight in that last great battle, then what must they fully possess? The Spirit of Christ. Isn't that right? And that Spirit of Christ is the power of God. That's the power of God. That Spirit. Now, our time is almost gone. We just started to get into this. Let's turn back to 1 Corinthians again. And here I have some dearly beloved verses that really appeal to me so greatly. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, and we'll begin with verse 17, where Paul says, for Christ sent me not to baptize, but to preach the gospel. not with wisdom of words, lest the cross of Christ should be made of none effect. For the preaching of the cross is to them that perish, what? Foolishness. But unto us which are saved, what is it? It is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and will bring to nothing the understanding of the prudent. Where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the disputer of this world? Hath not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? For after that, in the wisdom of God, the world by wisdom knew not God, it pleased God by the foolishness of preaching to save them that believe. For the Jews require a sign, and the Greeks seek after wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, unto the Jews a stumbling block, and unto the Greeks foolishness. But unto them which are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. Because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. For you see your calling, brethren, have not many wise men after the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called, but God hath chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise, and God hath chosen the weak things of the world to confound the things which are mighty, and base things of the world, and things which are despised hath God chosen, yea, and things which are not to bring to naught things which are, that no flesh should glory in his presence. Now let me pause right there. Why is it that the wise men after the flesh, the mighty men of this world, the noble men of this world, so seldom respond to the appeal of the gospel? And here it is in a simple word, because they're not prepared to empty themselves and take the place of a servant and become a nobody. Isn't that right? They've spent their whole lives becoming a somebody, and the only vision they have is the vision of a crown, never of a cross. And I suppose in the Bible the outstanding example of this is the rich young ruler. By hard work, industry, frugality and care, wise management, he had built for himself an empire of wealth, and he was a somebody. When he walked down the street in his wealthy clothes, people looked at him with envy and with respect, because the world does respect riches, they do respect power. And when Jesus said to him, if you will follow me, now you think of those words, if you will follow me, and the word follow me there means to tread in my footsteps, to live as I live, to be as I am. If you will do that, he said, you go and sell all that you've got and become a nobody and then come and follow me. And what was the price? It's too high. And he turned his back upon that marvelous offer and walked no more with Jesus. Now the very intent of the message of the first, second and third angels is to form a people who will with Jesus Christ empty themselves and become a nobody, and thus demonstrate the power of God to build the kingdom of God on this earth, and to successfully forever destroy the power of the spirit of Babylon, which says self first, self second and self all the way. Now we'll go on in our afternoon study. It's now time to stop, I'm sorry, as 45 minutes have passed. But we'll go on this afternoon to study more deep into the third angel's message before we move on to the fourth, fifth, sixth and seventh. And you'll appreciate when we come to the fifth, sixth and seventh angel's movements how vitally important our understanding of what God is trying to achieve through the preaching of the everlasting gospel in these last days. He's seeking to achieve the bringing out of a people who by their very natures exemplify the spirit of Jesus Christ and destroy the spirit of Babylon. Now God help us to understand these things is my prayer this morning. Let's take now our closing hymn. Number 295. He leadeth me, O blessed thought, O words with heavenly comfort fraught. Where'er I do, where'er I be, still 'tis God's hand that leadeth me.